project, Paul Martin, and I heard that's Nick Sayer's name. Gillen. Okay. And Nick Gillen from Democracy Now! Nicole is the archivist there, and Nick is the IT director. And they're lovely, and I guess I'll just let them
go. Hi. Thanks, everybody, for coming out on this rainy day. I'm Nicole Martin, and I work at Democracy Now! If I start to mumble, just give me a shout-out, because I tend to do that. I have an undergraduate degree from UC Santa Cruz in film and digital media, and I have a master's in moving image archiving and preservation when I got here at NYU. I've actually worked in the conservation department at Pope's Library, been a coordinator at the Lesbian History Archives for 10 years, doing an audio digitization project.
More of in a support role, like the questions that are really technical sort of deal. So Nicole's definitely the archivist. I'm not an archivist and don't pretend to be so. But I do have a background in data management and building very complex databases. So for cataloging questions, I'm here to answer them.
I think this is it's a good working relationship, and it's really good to have Nick here because if you're in an organization where you have a fellow geek to geek off of, then it's really lucky, and I think in digital preservation, IT support, and that kind of communication is super, super important. So, with that in mind, here we go. So, Democracy Now! Is. All right, that's Amy and Juan. They host the show. If you're not familiar with the show, it's a daily news show. It's an hour long. It's broadcast on over 700 stations as a television program, also over the radio and online. And it's many, many, many forms of journalism. I guess I'll just keep it basic. So I guess just very, very basically to begin trying to figure out what you might look like, and actually my presentation is sort of it's following the lines of yours a little bit, more than I expected, which I think is kind of awesome. So yes, this format is somewhat recognizable, but make a basic collection assessment of your materials. It's good to identify important content and collections, maybe materials that are at the foundation of your archives, things that are, items, things that are similar, but also maybe some historical interest, et cetera, et cetera. So try to group those things and prioritize as best you can so you kind of know what you're dealing with. Find unique materials, so last surviving copies of things. Sometimes it takes a lot of calling around to different organizations to see what they have, what you have, so they're doing the kind of research, which can be really fun and really frustrating and really awesome. Do you have masters? Do you have dupes? What else is out there? These are good questions to ask so that you know what you're getting into. These three kind of points too are also really good to keep in mind for grant writing. These are the things that you want to bring up if you're trying to solicit dough. Also find at-risk materials, things that are decaying, maybe are moldy. Certainly moldy things should be separated from the rest of the collection. Material that might be threatened by obsolescence or already obsolete. Put your laser discs aside. They're special. We can talk about obsolescence really briefly, but in the world of digital preservation, we're thinking about things eventual playback issues, not being able to view files, QuickTime files from 1996. that may or may not work now?
It takes a number of forms. I mean, let's say that you have a website that is on a zip drive. You know, there's two problems right there. If it's from 93, it's called for IE3. And who has IE3 anymore? I mean, good luck finding it. You could probably find it. So these are things to keep in mind in all forms. I mean, digital formats change.
Yeah, so for both hardware and software, most of them is like a really big deal. And we'll get into proprietary stuff a little later on, too, but that can be a big obstacle in keeping things around if a manufacturer or corporation changes their business plan. Preservation is like at risk. Okay. So, storage and handling of physical media. And equipment, computer equipment, devices, stuff like that. Start with magnetic tape. Magnetic tape likes to be stored from around 65 to 70 degrees. If you have access to quantum control facilities, that's great. It's good also for smaller organizations if you're willing to cooperate and find ways to share climate control facilities. Just like keep that in mind as a possibility. 25% humidity is good, but more important, I think for magnetic tape, humidity is more important than the temperature. Magnetic tape suffers from hydrolysis, which is like a condition where the tape binder, which holds magnetic particles down to the foundation of the tape that runs through the deck, but gets gooey and gross. And there's too much humidity, it'll clog up, the tape will clog up the heads of the deck and make the tape, like the magnetic tape, unreadable. So, keep it dry. Stable temperature is important. Fluctuations in temperature cause material changes. Also, it's good to keep tapes stored with their spines forward, or at least vertically, because if you store tapes on their side, the tape pack tends to rest in such a way that it gets uneven. Kind of shakes down. Keep it stored straight up, gravity will hold the tape tension. So keep it tight. Static is bad. Magnets are bad. Wood shelving gets moldy. Mold is bad. Metal shelves are good. Polypropylene and polyethylene cases are good. You can find them because they don't off gas. Other plastics will decay over time, and their gases will start like filtering around among your tapes and causing them to degenerate and like kind of have these strange and complex relationships with each other. You want your plastics to keep it simple. Break record tabs. You know what I mean? Okay. Optical media, same temperature and humidity. Information applies, as do cases. Use safe write pens, no Sharpies. If you must, write on the little hub, but Sharpie ink is, it smells bad. There's gas, don't do it. Safe write pens are the way to go. What's up with archival gold? I don't know if you guys have heard about archival gold, CDs or DVDs. Normally, I think the metal layer that the laser reads is aluminum.
Well, there's not usually a metal layer. It's usually, there is. I'm sorry. And then the silicon creates. You know, I'm not an expert on this, but there's definitely bits and grooves that cause the binary data to be recognizable by the laser that reflects on the metal layer. So I guess when it's gold.
Gold is supposed to be more stable than what I think is probably the other.
Create better reflectivity over a period of time instead of decaying maybe.
Yeah. It's more stable as a metal.
Yeah.
Like it doesn't rust and what aluminum's properties are. Anyway, there's this idea that archival gold CDs and DVDs are preferable if you should want to store your data on CDs and DVDs, but we used to joke in school that archival DVDs are it's like an oxymoron because they don't last very long. And they scratch really easily. And also, if you have to do like big data migration projects, which you should do since this media is unstable, ripping 1,000 CDs versus transferring media data, over hard drives, mean, opportunity is like a total nightmare for data transfer, so keep that in mind. And then recommendations for hard drives and other computer equipment.
I'm not sure on the physical properties in terms of temperatures and everything, because I'm not an architect, as I told most people here, except for maybe people who walked in. I'm just the IT guy. So I haven't actually been involved in storing. In fact, I don't recommend storing anything on hard drives. But in cases where you have old material on hard drives, and it's kind of like, wow, I have all these great pictures or all these great documents on these hard drives, you know, move it as soon as possible, first of all. But if it's there and it's just kind of like, well, I'll get to it when I can, don't power on those hard drives very often. The problem with that is that there's this motor that's spinning these disks, and there's a big head that spins over each disk. And if anything happens, and this is a very sensitive mechanical equipment, the heads will come down onto the platter where the data is actually stored and cause a crash. It's probably heard lots of times before. The more that the drive is powered off and on, the more likely that the crash is to happen. So keep the computers off or keep them on all the time, but don't turn them on and off. And this can get kind of tricky because in, like, for instance, Windows, the power management settings by default in a lot of computers, the drives will actually spin down the power down. While the computer is on, you wouldn't know otherwise. So just check your power management settings in those computers. But at that point, if you're going through that much trouble, you might as well just, like, get the data to a more safe place, like LTO tape or even optical media in some cases where it's more popular.
And also hang on to your original power supplies so that you're match. That's the problem that we have at Democracy Now! Trying to buy like sets of drives, and then I do my very, very best to hang on to at least one power supply from like that batch that we bought 2 years ago. But yeah, that's an easy deal. Okay, so then you might want to find a way to inventory and catalog your materials so that you have documentation and description for your holdings. What I have here is just like a list of possible fields that might be helpful to people who are doing cataloging of audiovisual or digital media. One thing that's cool about digital archiving is that making it a basic inventory is really simple. We have like these great command line tools, and there are ways to do reporting of like what you have in your directories that's pretty much immediate, and then files have their like associated metadata of like size, the creation date, modified by, and sometimes other like you know their technical specs if it's like video files or et cetera. So that stuff can all be collected and the data can be parsed and potentially mapped into like a catalog, which is really awesome. This is like one of the great benefits of digital archiving. So before you can do that, it's good to create a system of unique identifiers and maybe a naming system for your files. Everything at Democracy Now! Is our set of unique identifiers is determined by physical format. So, like, mini DVD tapes are like A129754 3, and DVD cam tapes are AD785. I think physical format, if you're looking at a media environment, it's really, really useful because categorizing things by content would be totally great for us. That's like no longer kind of sort of like DVD style. So we stick to physical format if there is physical format, and if there's not, we invent identifiers for digital formats. That's something I guess per institution you just kind of have to like discuss amongst yourself, but make sure that you come up with a strict name convention set of identifiers that you adhere to at all times. Can get everyone to agree. So, like, intellectual content fields that work for us at Democracy Now! Are unique identifier, title, content description. We make tape logs constantly, like second by second reports of what's in the video. I didn't make a note here for some kind of collection level, like, tag, but we have ways of keeping track of certain items as part of collections in our catalog, and that can be those tags can be applied. Except one media item can be a part of like two or three different collections, depending on how we structure how hierarchy of collections works. We don't really use subject and genre fields, but those are things just that some people like. And we think it's really important to have a new catalog if you're dealing with digital media where so many copies and different versions of things are possible. Like, so immediately is to have a field for related media so that you can link media items together that aren't don't have the exact same content but maybe have part of, you know, pieces of content. You know, spread across like several DVDs, DVD tapes, files. Technical metadata is particularly important for preservation reasons. Creation date is a format, digital format. Other metadata, condition and location information. So good to have some of that that could be parsed from command line report. And don't forget about intellectual property and rights information. Okay. Okay, now we have to move on. So, digital preservation. If you preserve things digitally, you'll have file formats. And in dealing with file formats, it's best to start, if you can, by working with like the native file format that your media is created in. So if there's a tape or a device that produces a certain file format because of the way it was manufactured, stick with that as like your master preservation file. Like if your camera makes RAW files, archive the RAW files first. And there's a chance, especially if you're working in a production environment, that you might be pressured to not take up server space with masters, digital preservation masters. We would just try to do our very, very best to always have copies of native file format. So in audio, the preservation standard that's sort of agreed on this WAV files. AIFFs are full res, and then after that, you start getting into compressed file formats that are great for access, but probably shouldn't be stored on the server indefinitely because they just take up space, and a lot of those compression recipes change so frequently that it's not really worth storing them for posterity for any reason. I mean, it might be worth keeping them on the server or online for reference, like as reference files, but not for preservation. The audio community has really like, gotten together and agreed on WAV, which is nice for them. But the main idea is just to like do research into the kind of media that you're archiving, find out which file formats as high res as possible. Learn if you can how old that file format is, like who made it up, where it comes from, so that you have some information about like how your media, why your media exists the way it does. Video, we shoot on DV, which is so all the outtakes, the show itself, the show on DV. So the file format that we use as the master format is .dv. It's not a wrapper, it's just like a DV, a data stream in a file. M2T files are the native format for HDD. We also shoot in HDD from time to time. Sometimes we have to, in this case we do, this is kind of detailed. but I guess just keeping, like just as an analogy, the DV file is a master file, but no one's ever heard of the DV file. But most people have heard of MOVs. So if we were to rewrap a DV stream into an MOV wrapper, it could possibly be read indefinitely. Whereas like 20 years from now, someone might pick up a DV file and be like, what is this? We can't get this back. This file no longer exists. Oh, but right next door there's this move and it plays out just fine. this is now the default name, Preservation Master, because no one knows what the heck it is. So, I don't know, fixes with it. MPEG 2 is like the native format for DVDs. MPEG 4 is FLVs, HD64 are all like compression formats. I don't know if you want to talk about AUG.
I mean, I personally don't deal with AUG extensively because support for it, except maybe recently, hasn't been the support for it hasn't been there. But it's a great idea, at least, and I really hope that support for it continues to grow because it started life as an open standard, which is something that we can talk about. Well, I guess now would be a good time. So we were talking earlier about longevity of the media, and one major obstacle to longevity is when you're dealing with proprietary media, proprietary formats, proprietary playback software, or anything like that, because it's controlled by a single organization, a single company, usually with all kinds of possibly nefarious motives or whatever. You know, I'm biased, I guess, but the general idea is no matter their motives, it's one organization, and if that organization collapses, so does the format. So when a file format or playback software, rendering software, is developed by a standards organization, developed by many people, many organizations, it is then kind of like public domain, and it can be extended upon, it can be modified, it can be supported more easily, and history proves that formats that are developed by standards organizations live longer, and in fact, even corporations are starting to open up their internal operations and their formerly proprietary property. Right? So, good stuff. Keep that in mind. If you have an option between proprietary and open, you know, take over. So that's why I was
doing this. So you guys podcast, which do you use all of that? When you do a podcast in your program?
Well, there are so many different
things. Yeah. So
like everything.
Right.
Well, you put the choice to the listener?
No. Well, yes. But podcast is sort of a different thing. It's basically you can subscribe and get a notification. We do only have one format for that, but if you go to the website, we have multiple formats. We do use AUG. Right. We also do MP4, which is wrapping an H.264 and an AAC audio file, which is listed in the
thing. Yeah.
Yeah. Which is an open standard as well. So H.264 and AAC are then wrapped into MP4, which are open standards, and they're widely supported by players, and so we kind of prefer that over AUG for the actual podcast. But yeah, images. So it depends on what you're doing, but TIFF is oftentimes used for print, and PNG is oftentimes used, PNG and JPEG and GIF are used for the web. JPEG and GIF have a long history of being proprietary, and so PNG was developed as an alternative to that. I'm not actually sure on the current status. I tried to do some research right before the presentation. I was so busy this week. But I think that JPEG might be developed now by a standards organization. Don't quote me if I do the research. But either way, PNG is a great format. It's wonderful for the web. And some people have a problem with getting it to compress and therefore prefer the other possibly proprietary formats like GIF. But there are utilities that will allow you to compress PNG down to very small and its appearance, it maintains the appearance that it had originally, at least in the human eye. So PNG is great. I strongly recommend it. TIFF is managed by Adobe, but I'm not sure of alternatives for print, unfortunately. They may be out there, and if you take my advice, maybe do the research and find an open print format for that. SVG is an alternative to some other proprietary formats that are dealing with vector graphics. So that's a great format, and it's up and coming as a possible alternative to Flash, which has so far been proprietary because it can do vector graphics. And I don't know actually what RAW is, but I think that's... Yeah, it's like... I think it actually has many different instantiations depending on the company, the camera company, so it's a really tricky thing. I don't really like it very much. In documents... this is a big topic. I'm getting really detailed. I'm sorry. But PDF has been standardized. And for a long time, it wasn't. It was maintained by Adobe. And I tried to stay away from it, but it was kind of ubiquitous, and you can't really stay away from it. But it's fortunately now standardized as of, like, August of last year, I think. And it's great. I mean, there are tons of free software, as in free and freedom, open source, viewers and creation software for PDF, so it's a great format in that regard. Doc and DocX are both Microsoft proprietary, and stay away from them as much as you can. But again, from an archival perspective, and I'm trying to get trying to stay there, I guess, from the archival perspective, if your source material, of course, is in any of these formats, you, yeah, like Nicole said, you want to keep that format and maybe derive keeping as close to the source as possible for another part of your archive. But Doc and DocX are really tricky. DocX is actually an attempt to have an open standard alternative to the ODX, which is at the bottom of that list there. And that is a true standard, which is based on XML. It's truly extensible and community developed. Microsoft came behind and created DocX, which is kind of a bastardization of the entire process. Excuse my French if that's a bad word. Text is just plain text. And I will get into this very quickly. Text has a lot of caveats. You have character sets for different languages and different characters that you can display on the screen. And some characters are actually not supported by all systems. So you want to take a look at that. When you're messing around with text files, in a lot of editors, you'll see that the encoding scheme is an option when you're going to save the file or to view it. You want to go with any encoding that's ISO, International Standards Organization. And you have like Latin 1, Western, and all these other things, but you don't want to mess around with Mac, Windows, anything like that. And if your files come that way, again, you know, keep the original, but you want to be dealing, when you're deriving particularly, when you're sharing these files in the organization, you want to be dealing with something that every viewer would not have a problem dealing with. And also, like, it'll come out as a huge issue when you're saving the file and putting it out on the web or through email. And it has these, what I call them proprietary characters, it might not be the right term, but they're characters that aren't supported by mailing systems and by all browsers. If you're ever on the web and you see a question mark in the middle of a sentence, that's the deal. Like, they put it through a system that couldn't see that character set, and it happened to be one of those little backtick quotation marks or something like that, right? So if you're saving it in ISO 8859-1, which is Western, ISO Western 1, or Latin 1, I think, then that wouldn't be an issue, and you wouldn't have that weirdness where, like, there's an ellipse character at the end of a sentence that becomes a question mark, and your entire meaning is gone. So that's a huge issue. And I don't know how interesting the rest of the formats are, but they're all basically plain text after XML. They're just various good standardized formats. So those are all good. The ones that stay with them are like Doc, yeah, and XLS. Yeah, and then for the web. HTML is plain text, which has all the caveats that text does, and encoding and all of that, text encoding. Swift is the kind of platform for Flash. It's, you can have a Swift player that plays a video that is an MP4 or an FLV, which is the Flash video format. So it's kind of the it's kind of an application, really. It's like a portable binary, really. And you have to have the Flash platform to display it. And then, see, for the web, you know, you might come across something strange like, I forget the name of it, but there are a lot of web development platforms, and the files for them you might come across, but usually they're plain text. You just have to find the display platform for it. So, again, just keep all that source material and consult an IT person. Like, how do I actually get at this? And maybe download that. So that's very important. Download the software that works now and archive that too, right? That way you don't come across the problem later on when you're trying to view this stuff. Where's the version of the software that this was developed for? Going back to the example I made, a website developed in 93 for IE3 or something. I don't know if that's the right year correspondence, but you know, wouldn't it be great to have the exact version of the browser for which that website was developed? I mean, a lot of times, even now, people don't develop their websites to look the same across all browsers. And that's especially amplified when you go back in time. So keep the version of the software that the web developer, web designers, intended it to be viewed on. Like, archive that material.
Yeah, actually, one of my professors had this really bizarre obsession with CD-ROMs and from doing research on where they came from and like the different like director tools that were made to create CD-ROMs. She started this project where she was like, archiving applications, like going back to like Mac OS 7, like every version of Dreamweaver, every like version of Final Cut, something. So everybody brought their wish to get their hands on. And yeah, it was like, he's getting spooky. She's having to like dig through SCSI drives. And it's great.
Yeah. Unfortunately, with proprietary software, you run into licensing issues. And just keep the software. Yeah.
Thanks, Lad.
Do you, in addition to archiving the software, then also computers themselves? I mean, if I have an application that's 1990 something or other, operating of that has changed quite a lot. So that is really old computers, but you know, they run like two programs.
That's a really good point, because in a really tricky technical situation, you can have software that runs just fine on your operating system, but use what's called a library. So, like, not all software is one unit. It utilizes other bits of software called libraries. It lives. And if the library version has been upgraded and it displays it differently, then there you go. You've got a different viewing experience from the original intent. And so, yeah, I mean, if you can do that, just kind of take a snapshot of the operating system in which the application existed, that would be optimal. Yeah.
It's true. Just for hardware too. I mean, like switching Apple from our PC chips to certain software, like no longer. So yeah, those old, keeping those old machines around is like a little scary to think about, but it's not crazy at all. To hang on to a machine that like runs an OS 9,
right?
Like
8.7,
right? Yeah.
So your university made you that? I know that at Barnard College, the academic technologies department is just trying to keep old machines and old everything. So, you know, see what your community resources are. You don't have to, everyone in this room doesn't have to have their own pile of computers, I don't think.
Do you have a good resource list for organizations, that tech companies that maintain kind of that knowledge? I mean, as I've over the years of using Mac, I mean, less and less technicians are aware of certain applications and can't really service it if I need to get back to it.
Not a central resource.
I did like a little bit of research on that last year, and the only resource that I found that seemed useful is there's a museum of like history of computing, and I think in San Jose, like in Silicon Valley, and they and they're the only online presence for that kind of resource. And I don't know how the public like interacts with them, but I haven't found much else.
But you know, I mean, old computer books are probably alive in some library somewhere. So worst case scenario, you could DIY, right? Like, go check out the book and you know, Windows 3. Here you go. Good luck with that.
Okay. Yeah, but, like, 14
zombie install. Okay. How do you save what's on your hard drive? You said, you know, the last resort would be putting it on CDs or DVDs, but...
Well, I wouldn't say the last... Sorry.
Well, what do you do?
Yeah, well, personally, I utilize tape backups, and for DN, we utilize LTO3. LTO 4 is just becoming accessible in terms of price per gigabyte, which is kind of a way of measuring large volume storage like that.
LTO is like 400 gig data tape.
LTO 3.
Yeah.
Yeah, and so and I think they're $30 roughly per tape. So you can see that the cost per gigabyte is pretty low on that, and it stored well according to the stuff she's describing earlier. You have it non-outgassing, you know. Case or anything like that, you have two copies in different locations, and you're good to go in that regard. And I strongly recommend that. But if your media is kind of stored and accessed in the same location, then doing redundancy in your drive configurations is entirely necessary. A lot of high-performance computers, even some laptops, come with what's called RAID configuration, redundant access. I'm not sure remember what the acronym stands for, but like redundancy is it or something like that.
Redundant array of independent disks.
Thank you very much for accepting. Right, and there are a number of ways to configure that, one of which is total redundancy, so that you have, you know, it's called mirroring of the drives. And you can have a combination of performance and all that, but it's getting too technical. So I strongly recommend that for a situation where you're like, well, I don't want to take the time to archive this on a regular basis, so I'm just going to keep it here in this way, that so at least one drive goes down, I'll be able to quickly swap in another one, copy the data to a new one, and have redundancy again. And if you have three, it's even better. Four is better, obviously. And so on and so forth. But you can get, just if that's too complicated, you can actually buy external like Lacy brand, I think is one of them. I don't really like them very much. There are other brands that don't know off the top of my head. I just kind of go with whatever's the best price, but and they have, they're called RAID configured external drives. Just search for that.
We talked about some of this stuff. So it's just like very basically benefits of digital preservation that's different from maybe seemingly different from the world that we live in every day, the physical world, is managing data and accessing data, doing fair use, moving stuff around, getting reporting on what you have in your archives, a lot easier. It's easier to make copies forever and ever, which is great for preservation purposes instead of like toiling in a film lab for hours and hours to make a very, very beautiful and accurate copy of some film of some sort. So this is much more immediate than that. And quality controls, reporting tools and analysis are much better. So, going back to the film analogy, you know, like rolling through films, doing really complex, meticulous film inspection, although it's so fun and very gratifying and crafty, is much more time consuming than coming up with using like some kind of data analysis software that can give you a report on where to drop out your video files may be, where you have like audio variations, weird anomalies, stuff like that, which is like much, much more immediate. There aren't really enough tools like that on the market or like in the open source community that exist yet. Moving along slowly, and I think once we as a community like realize the benefits of those tools for preservation purposes, as preservation becomes a bigger deal in the digital world, since it hasn't been around for long enough for us to understand how creating things will soon become, as the important things that we want to say become more digital and less real, we'll have these tools. I'm trying to drum up support for quality control tools, and hopefully the open source community will start working on something that we can all share together and test together. Not benefits, gadgets, related files and versioning madness, because copying is like so immediate and they're just like taking a snapshot of your server at any given time. Throughout time and show you how, like in a production environment, like how often files have changed, like at Democracy Now, like, a master of a program that might be produced may not have optimum audio. So we have these versions that are like, Chomsky Master, Chomsky Final Master, Chomsky Final Master, get over there. And, keeping all of those might be, it's
really hard.
Yeah. That can be problematic in terms of digital archiving. It's not expensive to save every single version the way it would be in the physical world. Hard drives not made for longevity, which means it's good to do data migrations. Keep your data on a cycle of migration, maybe every 3 to 5 years, since that's about how long we can trust hard drives right now.
And I would say that with these newer drives, these really like 500 gigabyte, 1 terabyte drives, the technology that allows for that much data to be stored in such a small space, the density of these drives, the technology is so new that these old rules we have about the longevity of a drive, to say like maybe 10 years at the most, they may not be correct anymore. You know, like there's so much more possibility of corruption in the material. So, maybe even shorter than 3 to 5 years on bigger drives. It's more than the models.
In terms of longevity, does the market now make any effort of keeping a paper record of transcripts of shows? Given that we don't know, 10, 20 years down the road, you know, if a file that you have now is going to be accessible, is there any effort at maintaining a hard record?
When we were going to the Democratic and Republican National Conventions this year, Amy was like, could you print out all the transcripts from the website? Because that's where they are. That's where we go to find them. And I was like, really? Like, you sure? you want me to print them out? And she was like, yeah, I want you to like print them out and put them in a binder for me so that I can have them physically. It's going to take a couple hours. She's like, yeah, so that's the only time we've done that. But no, they're stored in a couple places on the server. Transcripts are like golden, they're like 30. But yeah, there's something like paper. We talked about that in school too, like about printing out bits and bytes to be able to somehow reconstitute video. But going back to the Library of Congress's paper print collection of silent films, like a lot of the silent films that we now have access to in DC are not from celluloid, but were made from like in the early 1900s when films just beginning to have copyright. You would send paper copies of your films to the Library of Congress. And now those paper copies have been found, photographed frame by frame, and reassembled into moving pictures. I don't know if it's like the majority of silent film that we have, like American silent film that we have, is from the paper collection, but I think it's a larger percentage than you'd want to think if you were photographing moving images frame by frame.
Bringing them back out on the side. So, yeah, paper is awesome. Yeah.
Charge
punching. Yeah, and then the last point being the dependency on machines and the integrity loss. I think that when you're dealing with paper archives, again, I'm not an archivist, just to be clear on that, but and I've never dealt with paper, but. But I, coming from this digital world, I know how complex these things are. And most of the time when you're dealing with a machine, you don't understand the complexity that's going on. I don't understand the complexity that's going on, and I don't know anyone who does. I mean, like, every single bit of every piece of software that's going on to drive the system, not to mention all the hardware underneath it, it's just extraordinarily complex. So the huge mistake that can be made there is putting your archive in there and being like, well, the software says it'll do it, and it'll do it, right? So anywhere you can think of or have heard of a possibility of the integrity of your material being compromised, put some kind of check into place. Particularly, you know, in my experience, it's in databases. So, you know, for me, it's like values of data, right? So, like, I do a check on, you know, the type of the data, the length of it, and so on and so forth. But with media, it's pretty simple, really, to do a check to make sure that, for instance, when you transfer a file from one medium to another, that the data is exactly the same, and it's called a checksum. A lot of systems have this option, and a lot don't, and you don't often hear about it, but it's a really simple thing. It's basically a simple string of characters that identifies the whole of the media, and if any one bit changes, well, I should say byte, changes, the whole checksum will change, and you'll be able to do a comparison to say this string that's like 32 characters long is not the same. So look for that when you're doing transfers, any kind of work that's changing from something to something else. Unless you're deriving it and changing it into something else. But if you're trying to copy it, do a checksum on it.
Should we keep this to about 5 more minutes and then open some more questions?
There's
other stuff, but I want to hear what people say. Yeah, so we'll open it up to more questions and discussion. I happen to know that there is someone in the room who's good with art archives, so maybe we can talk questions on that. Maybe Chris will fess up. So why don't you just, someone who's up there can sort of conduct.
Well, I'd like to ask a question. Is there I'm in a software that works with multimedia. Like you can do photographs, you can scan all sorts of paper.
I'm not like a designer type person, I'm more of a developer, but I can tell you that in my world, in the Linux world, there's a distribution of software called MediaBuntu. And it's not necessarily in all cases proper for, you know, commercial production use. It may not be able to do all kinds of really complex color balancing or anything like that, but particularly for, like, you know, lower to mid-level needs, it's brilliant. It has, you know, a really advanced image manipulation program called GIMP. It has video manipulation, sound manipulation, all of that in one package. And it's very simple to use. This operating system here is actually called Ubuntu, which is a great African concept, by the way, but... and it's kind of like this, except it's bundled and it's really easy to use. Media Ubuntu.
Actually, this is probably a good time to pass out a handout, which is a list of open source like audio and video preservation archiving sort of, and also like conversion playback kind of tools. And they're helpful for like digitization, being compressed versions of your files, just like moving stuff around, manipulating stuff. They're kind of like digital craft tools, and they're all totally open source, so feel free to learn and use them.
And a lot of these have console-based other underlying platforms or alternatives that allow for more flexibility and control over the stuff. MPlayer is one great example. I just want to talk about that for a second. MEncoder, the underlying decoding and encoding software, is so powerful. It can transcode just about anything. It can filter. It can do really complex things, especially if you've got like a production line where your media is coming down the pipeline. Maybe I'm being really bad about this, but like, you know, if you've got really huge files coming down the pipeline and you do want to archive them, but they're just too huge, and you want your source files to be smaller, you know, MEncoder is a great example of that.
One other application I want to make a little plug for is Media Info. It's sort of new still, but there's a Mac OS X version of it. It's just like a little interface, you drop a file into it. Be like any media file, if you get used to document files too, but it'll give you all the technical specifications that it knows to record on. It'll give you a readout of like bit rate and runtime and the aspect ratio and like audio, all the audio like info.
And it can output to text, so it's easy to take that information and put it into another program that can then take out the individual fields and do whatever. So,
how many handouts are we short? Is there anyone that's like with someone that would be able to just otherwise, we'll put this up on the website or even maybe make more copies before we're done. Anyone else?
Another one I should give a little shout out for is Datastract. If anybody has like old DATs, Datastract is awesome. If you have a DAT drive for either audio or data tape, you can use the software. It has pretty decent recording also for like dropout, bad frames, et cetera, but like. No one ever thought that preservation was possible.
I just want to, kind of almost a general question, which is, say you digitize your physical materials, and what criteria do you use to say, okay, do I really need space to store this physical material, and now that I've had it digitized, do I go...
Always keep the original.
Always.
Forever and always, no matter how much it costs.
Okay, now what's your opinion?
Yeah, I have to agree with that.
You have to agree. So, regardless of, let's say you're coming down to a question of space. I don't have enough space for everything. I have multiple computers that I want, you know, back everything up. I have all the physical artifacts. Is there ever kind of a, it's a judgment call. Which side would you come on?
The example that I, love the most for not being able to play back obsolete or totally degraded media, or, you know, like, feeling that your original is, like, no longer, like, useful, is a story. There's a story that came out about a year ago about an audio sample that was recorded of, like, I forget the guy's name, but it's, like, Scott Brandt, who made the first audio recording on carbon paper in, like, it was like the 1830s, you know, before records or any, like, you know, wire recordings, wax cylinders, like way, like 50 years before all that stuff. Well, maybe 20 or 30 years before it. And there's no playback device for this recording. It's just kind of like a little sound wave, basically, like on a piece of paper in carbon. And like using a laser reader and like digital tools last year, they're able to finally play back this audio recording, the very first one ever made, ever. And it's like, you know, this like audible sample of singing a song.
Yes.
It was just like so haunting and beautiful and somber. There's no playback equipment for this when it was created. I mean, how useless is that?
I have a question about what's the best way to preserve, let's say, your record albums and video tape. What would you recommend you digitize it?
That's a good question.
So for
Record albums, let's say, and I want to move it to a new medium, what would be the best way of preserving it?
There's the first software tool is here, it's called Audacity, and it's it can be used for audio recording capture. It can capture high resolution files, just like any of the expensive programs out there, but it's like totally free. And if you hooked up a record player to an AD converter through USB or FireWire, there are a bunch of little boxes like that are made by like M Audio or MBox 2 is what we use at work. They all perform basically the same function. They're around like $300 to $500 each. And then the weakest link in that chain would be the record player itself, and in particular the needle that it uses, because different record grooves are, you know, use different needles. So like if you go to a digital preservation or an audio preservation house, they'll have like a little box of record needles that the technician uses and will test on the record. It's like a fisherman's box of flies, you know. And I've asked a couple of those people like how they choose, where they get their needles and how they choose them, et cetera, et cetera. But I guess trial and error and experience are, like, so the basic layout, just for preservation purposes.
For VHS, is
VHS, there isn't an agreed-upon standard for file format for analog video right now, and there are big arguments on like the Association of Moving Image Archivists listserv of like what in future we'll use. There's some really interesting history, like National Film Preservation Foundation trying to find a standard. They have a pretty good setup for preserving film, and part of the stipulations of the preservation that happened in the mid-90s. So it's come up with this analog audio or analog video standard for preservation. It hasn't been happened yet. So we're kind of in limbo. A lot of people have been transferring to digital beta tape, which is really expensive. Like the decks cost like $70,000 or $80,000, and the tapes themselves are like $80 each. So like people who have huge archives of analog video have preservation master copies on Digibeta right now, and that's kind of like where we're holding it really high.
And then in terms of cataloging your programs, you said you did it by your type, right?
Format
type. Is there a standard in the industry to have, I've done some shows on.
I personally prefer a program called Postgres, PostgreSQL. It's basically like MySQL, if anybody's familiar with that database platform. There are user interfaces for it that don't make it so complicated to use. Postgres has the same thing. They're web-based, and you do have to get someone technical to actually set it up, unfortunately, currently. There may be projects that I'm not aware of that make an entire package for user use. But these are definitely preferable, because when you start thinking about it, what I was talking about earlier, the integrity checks you'd like to do on your data, Postgres is wonderful with keeping the data integral and telling you when something's wrong. It'll actually not let the record be input until that problem is fixed. So, and it has a lot of other advanced functionality that make speed great. Like, if you have a really complex set of data, like you know, many, many gigabytes of just text data, you know, describing, you know, many events over thousands of years, I don't know, then it will allow you to index what's important and access the information based upon the most common type of query and things like that. They just make it so that it's integral and quick to access and just the kind of response type for that.
Right now, as Mark's known, we use a file maker pro database, which is like, excuse my name, go for it. Yeah, because it's a proprietary software, and although records can be exported like fairly easily, it's not as accessible like in a manual way with like MySQL or Postgres would be. And I think it's worth setting up a really solid like, database foundation, even if it takes a really long time, so to not have this like terrible uncomfortable feeling that all the data that you're entering into the system may or may not be recoverable at some point. Like a lot of like, very valuable information, the documentation, like a lot of hours put into this like super great original cataloging that you might not be able to move around. So like definitely put, do the research and put this time into a good database.
And at least if you're dealing with something like FileMaker, try to export to plain text as often as possible. In Excel, for instance, I mean, if you're not doing anything fancy like bullying yourself or you have like really complicated calculations in there, you can export to CSV, comma separated values, or a tab separated file, tab or CSV extension, and at least be able to preserve it in a plain text format. Be sure to check your file, your text encoding as well, of course.
Yeah,
yeah,
you just want to be as close, be able to get as close to your data.
The data itself.
As I'm looking around the room at people with their little handheld devices, do you have any like just gut thoughts about like preserving Twitter messages or just you know I don't know text stuff like that? Should people be thinking about that? I'm assuming especially the people that are here because they're here for the anarchist book fair, not because they're library and archives geeks, that you might want to think about that kind of stuff. So what do you think about that kind of stuff?
There's actually a committee of the Association of Moving Archivists that's forming around. It was the Infinite Mediators Group. That's a guy named Stephen Parr is looking into it. If anybody wants to talk to Stephen, he has great, great, great ideas and good things to say. But yeah, as far as what your voice. Yeah.
It's difficult because, I mean,
for
yeah, a lot of phones don't have an easy way to migrate your data out. I mean, if you can, it's just your contacts list. And that's in the area where free software, open source software, is coming, hopefully coming into being on the mobile platform, so you'll be able to plug in and do anything on your phone, access any of the data that's stored on there instead of what just the vendor wants you to access, and you'll be able to pull out those text messages and archive them. I have the same issue, by the way. I'm actually an archivist at heart, even though I don't know anything about it. So I definitely am like, wow, I wonder what mood I was in that day. I could look at my text messages and find out, you know, just stuff like that.
Mm-hmm. I totally, like, heard of the new school occupation Twitters to be for the Democracy Now archives, and then put them, you know, like, related those records to the video that we got from people who were shooting it, because that was really not good. Yeah. No, and my, you know, it's funny, is that my dad sent me a link to the Twitter stuff for the new school occupation. He's like, used to be a Republican. And I was like, you guys need this in your archive. I was like, really, Dad? So cool. But yeah, so we try to stay. But now what do we do? Like, there's PDF, we save in HTML, like how much HTML we save. There's an application called SiteSucker. I don't know if it's open source, but I think it's free and it does. And then, but yes, you can snapshot the time. There's also the Internet Archive, which I can't believe we haven't mentioned yet. That has the Wayback Machine. Snapshots of, like, more or less just like images of the web throughout time.
If you wanted to archive web pages just on your own, do you have a preferred?
Are you talking about someone else's or your own?
Somebody else's
folders, and what she was talking about, SiteSucker is an example, but there are definitely ways to do it with tools that can grab the whole site and you download all the images into a separate
and what would you recommend? What do you use?
I built my own.
Build your own, really?
I don't really know. I mean, because it's not that difficult. I didn't build my own. I utilized a lot of existing tools and put them together. So I don't know if it's unfortunately like a tool to do it, but there are a lot of tools out there. Just search for crawler, site crawler software.
Is it open source?
All the tools that I use, yeah, like wget is a terminal tool that I use, and the curl library, you can use these in software applications to just like get all of the content from a site and then put it into a directory. Yeah.
You can post
it. We use Zotero. It's a Firefox extension that saves the web pages and sort of catalogs.
That's great.
Yeah, right. I know when we planned this thing, we talked a little bit about, we have 4 minutes left, and I'd love for you to hit security.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I can only speak to digital security. I mean, I guess there are general methods for, like, you know, security. There are policy level stuff that, like, I'm not, you know, with an archive, I'm not the best person to talk to. Maybe you want to talk to that really quickly, just like policy level, like who owns this? What did they say?
The most experience that I've had with that was from the Finger Story archives, where there are lots of coming out issues involving, like, you know, donations and accessioning policy. We would just have, like, really detailed clauses about, like, who gets to see what, when, and what individuals. Our archives are very personal, so we could actually, like, be really detailed in our description of how people can access the archives. It's like, 50 years after my death, it's cool, everybody knows that I was lesbian, and I'm just sitting out, like, in the archives and see all my old papers, etc. But in terms of, well, the Hershey archives is also, like, very locked down. They have, like, a good relationship with the police and the fire department and alarm system that's, like, all tied into, like, the city's resources there. So it's been really cooperative in that way, which is great. We've had trouble with the mail before, and I don't really remember the details on that, but some of our mail has been filtered by the post office. Gay mail.
Yeah,
but, I mean, for archives to be filtered in terms of what they can send in and out, I mean, that's a huge risk for original stuff. So,
in the digital world, I mean, one of the biggest problems would be if you have your archive web accessible and you do have policy restrictions like that. So some materials should only be accessible to certain people. In that regard, you can implement a lot of... it's pretty complicated, I'm sorry. Yeah, I mean, so let's say that you give out access to people depending upon their login, so they have a username and a password. Well, they can save the username and password on the computer, so anybody who comes along after them can view the same material. So if you want to have a third level of authentication, it's something like a secret word that can't be saved on the local computer, which you can control with web development practices. You can also have, like, a key that they have to have in a drive, and if you're really getting into it, you know, and with certain, you know, activities that certain organizing groups are, you know, engaging in, maybe they don't want corporations or the government to have access to these materials, and that's a huge, huge concern, and there are lots of groups working on that. It's a huge topic, very important to think about all these people.
In terms of paper records, I mean, the only real security issue that you want to be aware of is if you're making your records available to outside users. And then you want to be aware of, you know, your employee information or volunteer information, anything that's like a sensitive issue that you wouldn't necessarily want the public to have access to.
All right, we do have to, like, restore this room and everything, so I kind of wanted to hear, although I do want to thank Luann, who's recording this so that it can be visually preserved on our website, since our website is back up. So everyone, I hope anyone who's interested will sign up for our announcement list and for the flyer about Radical Reference, and ask us questions afterwards. But stay out of our way while we put this here. Thank you so much, everybody, for coming. And thanks to Melissa for helping prevent this. Thank you so much.